Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 15, for June 12th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me. I've got a good show for you today. I hope you'll think so. Unfortunately, it's all me, which, you know, I guess could be a mixed blessing. If you like listening to me and my voice, then you're going to hear a lot of it today because I don't have an interview lined up this time. And partly that's because I really started to pile up some segments that I wanted to do that I'd prepared or that I'd started to work on. And each time I do an interview with someone, I tend to make that kind of the focal point of the podcast. And so, you know, I've been pushing off certain segments. And this time I'm going to kind of round them up and try to catch up a little bit. And I've also got a little listener email and an MP3 question I want to get to. And I've been putting a little bit of that off too. And so I'm going to kind of throw it all together and make sense out of it, I hope, in several segments today that I hope you'll enjoy. And just a quick word about listener email. I love it when you send me responses to the podcast, and particularly when you come over to the blog and post comments on pieces that I've written. I've mentioned this before on the podcast. I promise that I'll always respond to you, and I think I've been doing a fairly good job of that. Sometimes I fall a little behind, but then I get caught up when I can. If I don't read your email question here on the podcast, you can be sure that I will at least respond to you via email and try to answer your question. I hope that you'll continue to feel free to send me those, and I'm always grateful to receive them. So if you're listening to the podcast today, the day I'm releasing it, June 12th, 2008, you probably already know that this is Metal Gear Solid 4 Day. I personally have a great incentive to try to wrap this up as efficiently as possible because I know for a fact the UPS tracking number that I just looked at a minute ago tells me that there's a UPS man. It's almost always a man. I've not had a woman come to my door yet, but the UPS man presumably will be knocking on my door sometime this afternoon, I would expect, with a package that contains Metal Gear Solid 4, and I'm very excited about that. I'm a pretty big fan of the series. I'm not, you know, kind of a lunatic fan. There are some people. My friend Lee Alexander is over at Sexy Video Game Land. I've interviewed her in the past. I know that she's just crazy nuts for that series, and I'm probably not quite as far down the line as she is. But I really have enjoyed the series, and since I am kind of a sucker for narrative games, and you know, it would be hard to imagine a game franchise that has relied on narrative, often, you know, mind-numbingly confusing narrative plot lines and subplots and reversals and all kinds of crazy narrative tricks over the years. It'd be hard to imagine a series that's employed more of those, probably for better and worse, than the Metal Gear series. So I'm really curious to see what Kojima comes up with this time. I have such a tremendous respect for him as a designer, and you know, I wrote about this on the blog. I have these ideas about games and where they ought to go, and I'm certainly not the only person that's written and thought about this. You know, what do games need to do? What do they need to do differently? What's the future of gaming look like? And most of the things that I believe games should do and should try to achieve or in somehow ways to engage us as players, almost all of those rules are violated by the Metal Gear series. That's full of these kind of ponderous cutscenes, and the combat sequences are fun, but they often are very disconnected in terms of gameplay from the narrative. I mean, that there's some connection, but you know, mostly the missions are sneaking around and accomplishing certain things that get you closer to a goal, and that there is some narrative attachment there. You know, a lot of people, including me, think that games ought to do what they can to enable the player to experience the narrative through gameplay rather than sort of passively receiving it via cutscenes. You've talked about linearity in games and, you know, enabling the player to not be tied down to a strict linear narrative. And of course, you know, Metal Gear games pretty much violate that every time. And, you know, I've written, and others have too, about first-person shooters being a kind of a default gameplay mechanism that I'm finding sort of increasingly tiresome, hoping that games can give us experiences that don't have to be channeled through that I think, rather restrictive gameplay mechanic of shooting things, telling stories through the eyes of a person who's mostly got a gun in his hand shooting things. Again, Metal Gear breaks that rule too. You know, Kojima breaks a whole lot of rules, quote unquote rules, hopes, expectations, whatever you want to call them, that I have about games. And am I less excited about MGS4 for that? No, I'm just as excited as I could possibly be for the game. And I think it's mostly because, you know, I just think Kojima is a brilliant designer and a pretty good storyteller. I have some issues, and I'm not going to discuss them here because I'm sure I'll take a look at MGS4 and see if he overcomes some of these things. But I just think he's brilliant at getting the player into the game and getting the game kind of under your skin. And Solid Snake as a character, you know, one of the great, great, memorable, interesting, complex, befuddling characters in the history of video games. I'm fascinated by him as a character, and that's, I think, part of my interest in Kojima. And there's just such a kind of an auteuristic approach that Kojima takes as a designer. I mean, these are very, very much his games. They come from his sensibility and his aesthetic. And I'm a sucker for the artist as auteur, and I'm willing to overlook a lot of quote-unquote issues with a game or a film or a novel or whatever, if I sense that artist is trying to take me somewhere that's coming from a real personal place, a real, you know, kind of truly heartfelt place. And so that's another reason I'm very excited about Metal Gear 4. You know, and the other thing too, just one last quick remark about this. It seems clear, based on people writing about the game and people who've seen the game and things that Kojima has said about the game, that the game has an ambitious social political narrative, and that also interests me a lot. The idea that he's making a game which focuses on the industrial military complex, the ways in which war has been, you know, essentially turned into a permanent condition. You know, there are business ventures involved with war, and that if we take that away from them, they're going to make less money, and that there's an economic incentive to have war as a kind of consistent, perpetual condition. And Kojima's point of view about this, I'm not sure exactly what it is because I haven't played the game, but the fact that he has a point of view, that the fact that he's pursuing saying something about it, and regardless of where you kind of sit on the political spectrum, just the idea that a video game could have some point of view about this, something to say that will presumably have some kind of ambition attached to it, not just, you know, some kind of cursory knockoff political, you know, quote unquote framework, but more embedded into the whole gameplay and the whole narrative experience of the game are a number of fairly ambitious social and political ideas that Kojima believes in and wants to pursue. And, you know, that to me is terribly exciting. And so again, knowing that, I'm very happy to overlook the fact that it's very linear or that it's very cutscene driven or whatever. So anyway, if you're a Metal Gear fan, happy Metal Gear Day to you, the 12th of June. Can't wait to play it, and I'm sure I'll come back here and report on it at a future date. So I have three segments for you today, and then a fourth segment where I'm simply going to answer some listener email, and I have an MP3 question I'll get to. So one segment is called, What Do I Do With All This Freedom? It is a look at a game in particular, Burnout Paradise, that I spoke about and I've written about on the podcast here. In fact, Mitch Carpata in a past interview a few podcasts ago and I talked about it at length. I think I really blew it on this game. I mean, I think I really missed what they were doing with this game. And I want to kind of come back and take another look at the ways in which the designers of Burnout Paradise have kind of liberated the user, the player, whatever you want to call it, the racer, to experience this game in a different way. And the way that they have kind of stood behind this game and continue to roll out content and sort of, in some ways, I think, teach us how to play this game and teach us what this kind of game is like and what it means and the implications that it has on the future of video games. You know, no surprise here, I think we've often done this. A kind of paradigm shifting film or novel comes along, or a video game, and we don't get it at first. We initially are confused by it, or it seemed put off by aspects of it that seem to push us in ways we don't want to be pushed. And then, you know, sometimes later we come back and look at it and think, wow, this was actually a very important game. And I guess I'm going to contend in that segment, I'm kind of giving away my whole thesis here, that I think Burnout Paradise is actually a pretty important game and a real, sorry for the phrase, I know people, it's overused, but it's a paradigm-shifting game. I'll try not to use that phrase again in the segment. I'm also going to talk about the game I want to play. And the game I want to play doesn't exist. I'm going to just describe kind of what I want that game to look like and what I want that game to feel like and the experience I want it to deliver to me. And I'll talk more about that in the segment. I won't give anything away about that here. The game I want to play. And in the third segment, I'm going to talk about a game that I've written about on the blog perhaps too much. I don't know whether people are sick of it yet, but I just can't help myself. One of my favorite games of all time, a game called Beyond Good and Evil. And I want to try to go a little farther and try to be a little more careful here in the podcast than I was able to on the blog about why that game is interesting to me and what we know about the future of that game. There's a sequel that's been announced and some gameplay, or I guess a trailer footage that's been released. And I want to go a little bit farther than just the game itself to talk about kind of the differences between directed, kind of developer-driven narrative and more player-controlled narrative that we may be more familiar with in like RPGs, and how those two ways of delivering a narrative experience differ. And the ways in which some modern games, particularly Grand Theft Auto 4, have tried to kind of have it both ways, with both a directive and a player-controlled experience, and how tough it is to do that well. So, you know, a kind of a look at narrative as it applies to Beyond Good and Evil, but then kind of extrapolating out to think about what modern games might do to learn lessons from Beyond Good and Evil and build on that. So that's the show. I hope you enjoy it, and away we go. I was very excited when Burnout Paradise came out, partly because I'm a big fan of the series. And I got to say, I've never been able to really manage games like Gran Turismo or the Forza series. And that's mainly because for me personally, they're just a little too fussy. They're too technical. They're very, you know, they're attempts at realistic simulations of racing. And maybe it's just that I'm not good enough at them to enjoy them. But I just find the whole tweaking all the little settings and just how difficult it is to not crash into to the walls. It's all just very, very hard for me, and I never enjoyed them. Burnout seemed to really get it right for me. It had that beautiful kind of arcade feeling and this tremendous sense of speed that I think beats anything that Need for Speed or OutRun or some of the older racing game series did. Burnout to me just really hit it exactly right. And that sense of speed that the game gives you, this sense that you're kind of hurtling forward, just barely staying alive, you know, narrowly missing all kinds of crashes and kind of hurling forward into traffic through intersections. And when you do crash, they're spectacular, fantastic crashes. So the game had a lot to offer, and I spent a lot of time with the previous games. So I came to Burnout Paradise already a pretty big fan. When I first got the game, I loaded it up, and of course, you know, I was kind of blown away by the visuals. It's a spectacular looking game. It really looks fantastic. I first played it on the 360, and now I'm playing it on the PS3. But either way, it looks great. So, you know, your initial kind of introduction is, wow, this is Burnout for the next gen systems. Great. But it didn't take long for me to sort of get a feeling similar to the feeling I had when I first started playing Elder Scrolls Oblivion, which was, you know, wow, this is a lot of freedom. What do I do? And in Oblivion, and I think it's a kind of an apt comparison in some ways, there are missions for you to accomplish, and, you know, you can get involved in a guild or whatever and, you know, plow your way through the main narrative or the sub-missions, and you'll have fun, but you can also just kind of walk around and explore the environment. And while I found making my way through the main storyline of the game interesting, I have to say, after a while, I don't know, it just stopped being interesting to me. And maybe the combat became repetitive. Maybe the story, such as it was, I found difficult to follow, or it just didn't compel me. But after a while, for me, with Oblivion, as much as I admire the achievement of that game and the way that it opens you into an RPG experience that really gives you a lot of freedom, for me personally, it just felt like too much freedom in an odd kind of way. And I think in some ways that may be due to the fact that it is such a single player experience that if those NPCs aren't sufficiently interesting, sufficiently engaging, and if the world itself doesn't give you more and more to do, and in some ways it does give you things to do, but it's often just different versions of similar dungeons you've already been in, caves you've already been in, creatures you've already fought. And I don't know, after a while, it just stopped drawing me in. And that was my first thought about Paradise, that this version of Burnout seemed to me to offer a lot of options for me driving around. I could pick up races. I could pick up different game modes and have a certain amount of fun. After a while, I just sort of wasn't sure what else I was supposed to do. And as good as the game looked, I just didn't quite get it. I tried the online multiplayer, and that was fun. Technically, it worked well. Didn't really have any lag issues, so that was fun. But I don't think I gave it enough of a go, and I don't think I really exposed myself to it long enough to really get a sense of what the possibilities were for that. But, you know, coming back to the game after time away from it, and really in some ways just slowing down and letting the game kind of teach me, show me what it's offering me, has been a really rewarding experience for me. I think, and this is sort of embarrassing to admit because I think I'm a pretty hardcore gamer, but, you know, initially I just wasn't guided enough by the game. The game didn't tell me what to do enough for me. And it's silly, I know, but that's what I was used to. You know, go to a menu, open it up. Here is a race I can run. And here are five more that I can't because they're still locked. But if I win this one or if I win this circuit, then this will unlock and I'll go do that. This is how I've been playing racing games forever. And that's what I expected with Burnout Paradise. And of course, you don't get that. There are no menus. There are no loading times. There are no online lobbies. Everything is organically connected in this kind of open world setting. You know, even going online, you can be anywhere in the world of the game, press your right directional pad, and boom, you're online. And you can choose what sort of mode you want to play in. You can invite friends. And after you've made your choice, you're right there in the game, right where you were. When you want to leave, you know, exit, and the world continues in its state, and those online people just sort of disappear, but you're still where you were when you were online. The persistent open world nature of this game is really incredibly impressive, and I just didn't sufficiently appreciate what all that meant. But now I do. Now I find that driving around the city and really sort of taking your time and taking a look at it is a pretty extraordinary experience. I mean, it's a very rich world. People talk about Grand Theft Auto 4 in this way, like it's some kind of revelation. You know, look at all the things you can do, and you can run around and you can see New York City, and it's incredible. And it is. I don't want to take anything away from GTA 4 in that regard. But I got to tell you, Paradise City is a pretty damn compelling place as well, visually and otherwise. It's chock full of things to do and a lot of variety in those things. There's a lot of racing, but very different racing, you know, in city racing, a lot of traffic, a lot of intersections, and also what feels more like open road racing and out in very curvy, hilly areas and a lot of stuff in between. And really, I think what I began to appreciate about the game is that if you want that kind of aesthetic experience, that, forgive me, but I'm going to return to a phrase I've used before, this kind of meditative experience, an experience where you really aren't necessarily playing the game or dealing with any kind of structured set of missions or goals. If you just want to drive around, you can do that, and you don't even have to drive fast. You can, you know, kind of tool around, and it is strangely, oddly become more interesting to me suddenly. I don't think that I sufficiently understood that what this game offers you is the opportunity to define your own level of engagement with the game, that you could create kind of your own entirely fictional, you know, engagement with this world where you just drive from one place to the next, change cars, you know, don't have any purpose at all, just drive around, try to drive fast, try to drive dangerously, try to knock out other cars without crashing. You can do all kinds of kind of, you know, emergent gameplay stuff that comes out of this set of experiences that the game offers you. But if you do want to engage in more structured ways, the game offers you that as well. You just have to be willing to explore a little bit. And this is a game, and I'm going to argue, unlike Oblivion, I'm sure people will disagree, this game really rewards you for exploring. And the reward isn't just about giving you more to do or offering you little nuggets that you can kind of discover by running into them. But the game also rewards you for learning the environment, for learning the city. And this is where I really ran into a lot of trouble at the beginning. I had a very hard time navigating the environment. It's actually not a very big geographical space. If you look at the map, it's a very complex set of streets and roads and tons of places to go, but geographically speaking, it's a fairly small area. And it is possible, if you take your time and if you're willing to do it, to learn how it all lays out. And I've now come to that point where I've developed an instinctive sense of where I am, where things are. And as you discover things, they appear on your map. So, you know, you're rewarded for learning where the paint shops are and where the gas stations are and the repair shops and all those sort of things. And now I kind of know where they are without looking at my map so much. And again, the game rewards a certain kind of investment on your part. And I just wasn't initially, I guess, willing to do that, or I didn't do it. Now, of course, online, your engagement with other drivers can come in all kinds of ways. And the modes of the game that are available to you as a single player are mostly there online as well. So if you want to crash, if you want to race, if you want to do whatever, it's all there. But you can also just kind of mess around. And this is what really has turned out to be a lot of fun for me. You know, you just jump in and you can kind of play chicken with people. You can kind of create your own kind of in-game demolition derby and kind of see who survives. You can do a lot of things with other players in this game that, again, as you're doing them, you realize that you as players are really creating this game. There are modes that you can stick to, but you don't have to. And winning races is really, there are a lot of ways of doing that. You can stick to the prescribed path from A to B, and whoever gets there on that path could win, but it's very likely that the winner will be the person who takes the shortcuts and finds the coolest ways. And there isn't just one or two solutions there. You can take any route you want to get to your destination. So the game rewards you and gives you options for being able to play it in your own way. You may decide you want to be very aggressive with the other drivers and kind of stick with them and try to take them out. You may decide that you want to try to, you know, avoid all contact with them as much as you can and just take an alternate route. And when I say alternate route, there are a lot of ways in this game of getting from point A to point B. And I don't feel like I'm anywhere near knowing what they all are. But again, the game provides you with all kinds of opportunities to play it in your own way and to engage with the environment in your own way. And the fact that the game doesn't insist on any of them can initially give you the impression that the designers didn't make any decisions, that they just kind of threw it all together and, you know, they've put the onus of how to play the game on you. They just sort of created this thing and disappeared. Nothing could be farther from the truth. It's very clear to me, the more I play it, that your experience is framed by this incredible set of opportunities and challenges that can be overcome or achieved in all kinds of different ways. And how amazing it is that none of those ways break the game, if you know what I mean. That you can do it your way and there's no such thing as cheating. You know, if you can figure out a quicker way of going from A to B, then more power to you. And the game gives you all kinds of chances to figure that out. You really feel like you own this world the more you get to know it. You're not controlled by it. You're not limited by it. But in really cool ways, you are given the opportunity to kind of master this world. That's a pretty amazing thing when you consider how complex the world of Burnout Paradise is. And of course, they did all this without losing any of the core racing experience. Burnout Paradise is just as good. It's 60 frames per second. It's just as fantastic as any of the earlier Burnout games. Better, in my opinion, because it looks so good. But that pure, raw Burnout racing, that beautiful kind of arcade-ish feel, but not too crazy, silly arcade-ish, that experience remains intact in this game. It gives you a tremendous sense of speed and this just visceral feeling of, oh my God, how much longer can I go without crashing into something? I'm barreling past cars and I'm not sure where I'm going and I'm not sure where the next turn is. I'm just going to hope for the best. And you really are kind of hanging on by your fingernails at certain points in the game when you've got that boost going and you're flying at an unbelievable speed. Now, the other thing I want to mention about the game, and I think this is the element that really puts it over the top for me, and it's another thing I didn't sufficiently understand from the beginning. This game is very alive, and it's alive not just in the sense that there's all this emergent gameplay that can come out of it, or that you can play with real-life players multiplayer. It's alive for other reasons, and those reasons have to do with the developers' Criterion Games' constant efforts to keep the game new and fresh by adding content, by adding new modes, by adding new areas of the world which are coming, all kinds of responsive, player-directed content kind of coming at you from them in little installments, similar to the way that massively multiplayer online role-playing games like World of Warcraft have done, where you know, the developers add content to the game over time to keep the experience interesting for the players. That's very much the philosophy that Criterion Games has for Burnout Paradise, that they've already released an update called Bogart. Of course, they've totally got me in the palm of their hand with these names. Any film nut's going to have a warm feeling in his or her heart when you hear the names of these updates. One is called Bogart, which has already been released. There's Cagney, Davis, Eastwood, but each of these updates adds content, and I mean, you know, significant content, new modes, new cars, new locations. The Eastwood update, which is the one that's sort of the farthest one out, will add islands that can be connected through bridges so that the game world expands and new areas open up. And from what the developers have said, there's also going to perhaps be some underground racing and areas where you can explore. So the game continues to grow. The content continues to grow. But the coolest thing to me about all this, and of course, where a lot of this content is emerging from, is a kind of community engagement that the developers have clearly decided to continue as vigorously as possible, a kind of engagement with the community that is resulting in a real conversation between what players want and what the developers are doing. This is partly an online presence at their website. It's partly a series of podcasts called Crash FM, now also called Crash TV because they've added video to it. Last time I checked, I think they're on their 34th or 35th podcast. These are I think, weekly podcasts full of conversation, email answering, explanations of what they're working on. Now they've even started releasing video of developers at their stations with their monitors, sort of showing you what they're working on and explaining, you know, what their intentions are for what they're working on, really kind of opening up the process of developing the game to the community and trying to be responsive to the feedback that they're getting and thinking about how content can emerge from this conversation. This is incredibly exciting to me. And I just, you know, you got to take your hat off to them for the courage I think that they've shown with this game, a game that probably defied the expectations of a lot of hardcore Burnout fans. A lot of people, I would imagine, just like me, sort of took an initial cursory look at the game and thought, it's not like the old Burnout. I don't like it. Too open, too, you know, what am I supposed to do? Why do you make me start over at the original spot and I have to drive all the way back there if I fail or don't win a race? I've got to navigate all the way back to that spot. This annoys me. I'm not interested. I totally get that reaction because I did have it. But I would really urge you to sort of drop the other games you're playing for a while. And I think that was part of my problem is I tend to play three or four games simultaneously and kind of bounce around. Just give Burnout Paradise a little time to let it sort of show you what it is and to teach you the kind of game experience it wants to give you and kind of give over to it. Think about the game less like a racing game and more like a GTA game where you know that you're not just going to be able to jump in and sort of get it right away. The game will have to reveal itself to you in some ways that you'll find interesting. And if you just sort of let the game have its way with you, you'll be rewarded. I certainly have been. And, you know, they're going to be adding nighttime effects. They're going to be adding bikes. They're going to be adding all kinds of stuff that they've already announced, a lot in response to what people have asked for. And everything that I've seen suggests to me that their commitment to this game is a long-term affair and that you can count on, you know, being able to play this game for quite some time. It's interesting. Edge Magazine's review of the game ended with a phrase something like, this may be the last Burnout you'll ever need to play. And I wondered what they meant by that. And I think I now have a better understanding. If they continue to develop the game as they have and release downloadable content and other sort of stuff, it really, in many ways, the game just continues to feel alive to me. And when you add the multiplayer component and all the ways that people are discovering to play this game together and challenge each other in ways both structural and improvisational, I have every reason to think that I'm going to be as interested in Burnout Paradise in 6 months as I am now. And that's a pretty unusual feeling to have about a video game these days. In my previous podcast, I interviewed Steve Gaynor from 2K Marin, and shortly after that, he issued a challenge to gamers everywhere to think about designing a game. If they could design any game they'd like, what would that game look like, and what sort of story would that game tell? It got me thinking, and I've really been thinking quite a bit about this ever since, what game would I design, or what sort of experience as a gamer have I been looking for but never really felt I've had? And I don't know why I made this leap, but my mind immediately went to a game called Majestic. I don't know if you've heard of this game. I'll just briefly describe it. Majestic was released by EA Games back in 2001, in July of 2001. And it has since become categorized as a alternate reality game. Alternate reality games are efforts to kind of blur the lines between a fictionalized world of a game and the real world that you live in. So it's not unusual for an ARG to kind of cross those lines a fictional character in the story calls you on your phone or sends you an email or somehow interacts with you in your real world environment, and you've got to kind of cross those lines to figure out, solve puzzles, communicate with other players, whatever, but somehow interact with that alternate reality from the world that you're currently living in. For example, you're in your office and your phone rings and it could be somebody telling you there's a conspiracy and filling you in on all the details. So Majestic was really one of the very first efforts in this direction. And I got to tell you, when it first came out, it just so captured my imagination. Really, the idea of the game more than the game itself. And I think regarding Steve's invitation, it's really the idea of Majestic that has me excited, far more than the game itself. Majestic had this really brilliant way of drawing you in at the beginning. You basically install the game and it sent you through this little tutorial, and it sort of showed you how to play the game, and, you know, typical, you know, game tutorial. And so your next move really was to log in to a server where you would begin to interact with the game. And when you tried to do that, the server that you were attempting to log into is reported as being down. So your first thought is, like this game doesn't even work from the first moment I started playing it. And for those of us who are veteran gamers, that's not an unusual thing. You know, that's one of those things that just pisses you off because you've faced it before and you're like, this thing is like, it doesn't even install properly. So that was my first reaction to the game. And right after that, I received an email directly from EA, basically informing me that there had been a fire at the facility where the servers were housed, and they were really sorry. And they give you a couple of links to click on for more information. You know, please stick with them. They're going to get right on it. Well, if you click on these links, you go to a site that suggests to you that the fire in this building where the developers are housed making this game Majestic may have been, you know, set under suspicious circumstances. And before you know it, you're getting contacted by developers who are working on this game, Majestic, who are suggesting to you that actually there's way more that you don't know about this that you ought to know. And of course, suddenly you're being drawn into this game. So it's all a kind of a fabricated thing at the beginning. And it's, you know, I was very impressed by it. I thought it was a really cool way of drawing me in. Unfortunately, the game really didn't make good on all of its promises. And there are a number of reasons for this, not the least of which were that it was an amateur-looking effort, in my opinion. It required a certain kind of engagement with other people, calling you or faxing you or sending you videos or audio messages. And these really had the ring of, you know, sort of amateur hour to them. The acting is pretty bad. The voice acting was pretty bad. The faxes were pretty cool. I actually saved a couple of the faxes. But, you know, all in all, it just kind of fell apart in execution. The idea of it really very compelling to me initially, but I quickly found myself kind of getting off the bus, if you know what I mean, because it just wasn't going somewhere I wanted it to go. Now, I have to be honest, there were a couple of other reasons, I think, why I didn't persist in playing the game. And, I've played games that I haven't necessarily enjoyed so much, but I'm really interested in kind of the way the game is built or, you know, how it's put together. I tend to tolerate maybe some things I might not like about a game if it seems like it's going somewhere new or interesting. But I didn't with this game. And there are a couple of reasons. One, I was single at the time, and the person that I was seeing, I sort of explained to her that I was going to be playing this game and that the phone would be ringing and it, you know, might not actually be somebody real, but it could be somebody part of the game. And of course, you know, she thought the whole thing was just ludicrous. And I suppose it was to some degree, but, you know, I'll just, as an aside, the woman that I'm married to now would think it was very cool, which goes to show that I'm glad I married her and not the other woman. Anyway, that's an aside. What I wound up doing to sort of make it easier for her to sort of accept this idea of phones and faxes and email messages was I permitted the game to preface each of these with this little disclaimer, which was an option. So when you install the game, you can say, actually, when you call me or when you send me stuff, I want this disclaimer at the beginning saying, this is all part of EA's Game Majestic. It's not real. And now here comes the message, right? So that enabled her to be able to quickly see that that phone call wasn't for her and she could hand it to me or whatever. And that made her happy. But it ruined it for me, right? Because I mean, the second you get a disclaimer, the whole immersive role-playing suspension of disbelief thing is it's sort of blown, you know, it's kind of ruined. So that's one reason why I didn't persist with the game, I think, is just it didn't function for me like it should. The other reason was really somewhat more somber and more of a real barrier to sort of feeling like I wanted to play this game. And it's that, you know, the game was released just a couple of months before 9/11, and I don't remember, to be honest, when I bought the game. I don't think I bought it the day it came out, but, you know, probably somewhere in that month between the game being released and the month leading into September. And I just lost all desire to play this game after 9/11. You know, the whole game is predicated on these series of government conspiracies, and there's this attack, and it's suspicious circumstances, and it was a little too close, it felt to me, to stuff I wanted to deal with or think about. And I would imagine that there were probably many, many other gamers that either gave up on the game or just never bought the game purely because of the kind of dissonant feeling that it gave me in the wake of sort of how we were all feeling in this country about 9/11 at that time. So, you know, I think these things and the game not being very well built probably all conspired to make this game fail. And it really was one of the great spectacular failures, I think, in the history of video games. It got a tremendous amount of attention leading into its release and ultimately did very little business and sold very few copies. But now when I think about that game, it just feels to me like now is the time for a proper, well-designed, cleverly conceived version of Majestic. And of course, it doesn't have to be Majestic. It could be any game, a totally different story. I'm not asking for a remake of Majestic, but the idea of Majestic, what that game could have been, now it feels to me is the time for this game. One big reason, of course, is all of the interactive social networking, kind of persistently online possibilities that are available to us that really weren't so available in 2001. I mean, when you think about how a game could kind of infiltrate your life through, you know, Twitter and through your text messaging, your phone, voicemail and email, and all the ways that we're sort of constantly in touch with each other, if the kind of the tentacles of this game could somehow reach out at you, if you're willing to do it, you know, you have to sign on to it, obviously. You're permitting the game to do this, but that's sort of half the fun to me. If it came at you in all these really cool and interesting ways using all these social networking tools and interactive tools that we have available, how amazing would that be? I mean, that just seems to me, if it were done well, it would be so cool. Of course, there are problems in creating such an environment, in the sense that if you want to get away from pre-recorded messages and pre-recorded video, which is what Majestic relied on, and really, really up the stakes by making these live people, it would logistically be a very difficult thing. I mean, imagine I receive a chat message through my AIM client, let's say, and somebody's telling me or giving me information about something related to the game, and I interact with that person and it's a live person I'm talking to, or my phone rings and it's a live person I'm talking to. The possibilities there, particularly from the role-playing side of things, seem just incredibly exciting to me, but obviously also logistically very difficult. Now, when I posted a story about this on my blog, the conversation that ensued afterwards was really interesting to me. And of course, as often is the case, the comments, I think, are often more interesting than my actual posts. But someone suggested, I think it was LB Jeffries, my old pal LB, said, well, you know, what you really want here is for both sides of that equation to be role players, for everyone to be a player, that you create the structure and the framework of the game, and then you basically the player who's on the receiving end of the game is a real person, of course, but also in ARPG parlance, the puppet master role, the ones that determine the rules of the game and push it forward. What if those were also role players? And what if within certain very well-defined parameters, I could function on that side of it as a player and derive what I would imagine to be a fair amount of fun dealing with people in the environment and in the persona of a person inside the game. I mean, how cool would that be? I'm just excited thinking about it, just the possibilities. Interestingly, then, that branched off into another way of thinking about the experience. You know, just this week, a couple of days ago, actually, you know, Steve Jobs is at the latest Worldwide Developers Conference for Apple, and he's showing the iPhone, the new one. And of course, they've unveiled all these new applications, and they've got the software development kit out to everybody to make applications for the iPhone. Well, I mean, wouldn't Majestic be the perfect iPhone game? I mean, it's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? I mean, you've got that thing in your pocket and it goes off. It could be sending you email. It could be sending you a phone call. All of your interaction could be sort of centered in the game on that iPhone. It's got a GPS. So, you know, now suddenly it's just gotten exponentially more interesting because now the game knows where you are. This is awesome. I mean, I'm just sitting here imagining this game and I'm getting more and more excited about it. Somebody has got to make this game. Somebody has got to make this game. I would buy it in a second and I would drop every other game I was playing and devote myself purely to this game. Now, it has to be done well. It has to be done well. And Majestic, it probably kind of poisoned the waters to some degree, because if that's what people think about with this kind of game, it might discourage them. The other possible discouragement for me personally, potentially discouraging anyway, is ARPGs have typically of late been associated with promoting products, right? So you may be familiar with these kind of alternate reality games related to the introduction of a game like Halo 2, which that the I Love Bees campaign was about, or other products that have started these fake websites and fake PR and fake announcements, and fake emails, and all these things that have essentially been leveraging this alternate reality game concept to market products to you. And while I think those are interesting, I'm personally not terribly motivated to kind of get into that world where really what it's all about is to try to convince me to buy a product. Now, having said that, as someone else pointed out over on my blog, you know, if it's good, it's good. I mean, if these are well-designed games, to a certain degree, it shouldn't matter what they're in service of. Maybe there are things we can learn from how these games are built that we could then incorporate into a game that in fact isn't a promotional game, but that is a self-contained real game, you know? And maybe that's the case. Maybe so. You know, if you ask me what game I want to play, if you ask me what sort of game experience I want to have a Majestic experience on my iPhone, and I want it to surprise me. I want it to frighten me. I want it to completely immerse me, and I'm ready to play that game. Beyond Good and Evil is a wonderful game. It's one of my favorite games, and I've spoken of it here before, and I've written about it on the blog often. And I return to it now, and I wrote about it very recently again on the blog, largely in response to a trailer that was released by Ubisoft at the end of one of their press events last week. And it was a trailer that showed what they claim to be game engine-driven graphics from the upcoming game, a sort of sneak peek at what that game will look like. Now, one thing we know, if we've been watching trailers for video games for much longer than, oh, say, 10 minutes, is that video game developers and publishers often show us things that later don't seem to bear much relationship to the game that they were initially supposed to represent. And in this case, I really hope that's true, because I was terribly disappointed by the sort of hyper-realistic visual style of the trailer, and I'll return to that in a minute. Beyond Good and Evil is a terrific game for a number of reasons, but it's not a perfect game. I think there are certain things about it. The combat is probably a little repetitious. Perhaps some of the level designs and puzzles aren't as clever as they might be. But overall, the game really is, for a variety of aesthetic reasons, I think, a terribly ambitious and terribly impressive effort. I love a lot of things about the game, and I'm impressed by the degree to which the game moved me emotionally and engaged me intellectually as well in the story. I love the story of the game. I love the atmosphere of the game. I love the art style of the game. And more than anything else, I love the heroine of the game, Jade. One of my favorite characters in any video game. And a big reason why I care about her as a character is because of the relationships that she establishes in the game, the orphans that she takes care of at the orphanage, and of course her uncle Paige, who raised her and whose relationship and interactions with her in the game are among the most delightful of any I can think of in any video game. And I'm not going to go on and on about them here. I've written about them on the blog, and you can go to the blog and read more about my notion of relationships and how central they are to our understanding of characters in video games. But what got me interested in returning to Beyond Good and Evil, aside from the fact that it was just fun to pick it up and play it again, which I did recently, is this trailer by Ubisoft and a kind of visceral reaction that I had to it, and how disappointed I was by it. And when I began to examine what is it that made me disappointed in that trailer, I began to, I think hard about the core aspects of that game and what those aspects mean to me and how central they are to the very identity of that game. For one thing, and this is so typical, I think, unfortunately, these days, you know, oftentimes developers translate more horsepower into more realism, that because they have so much more to play with under the hood of these machines that these games are built for, there's so much more power there. It enables them to do things that obviously they couldn't have done 3, 5, 10, 20 years ago. And those limits, in some ways, I think, enabled designers in those earlier days to think more creatively about how to render a world, knowing that you couldn't do a photorealistic depiction. I liken this in some ways, and I realize this is a slight stretch, but I liken this in some ways to the early days of the cinema when filmmakers had to deal with the Hollywood production code. It was a very limiting, very rigid set of rules and regulations as to what you could say and what you could show and what you could do in motion pictures. And those rules really persisted from the 30s all the way to, like, you know, the mid 60s. And it started to kind of fall apart when foreign films entered this country and kind of suggested there were other things you could do with motion pictures than the Hollywood filmmakers were allowed to do at that time. But what happened, oddly enough, in the 30s and the 40s, I think in particular with film noir and certain kind of romantic comedies, is that Hollywood's screenwriters and directors began to figure out ways of being very clever and also in some ways very coy with those rules, playing within them, stretching them, figuring out ways of saying what they wanted to say without technically breaking a rule, but very cleverly embedding into either a script or the mise-en-scène or some kind of framing of a shot or a certain look in a certain actor's eye or whatever, that these restrictions that handicapped them when it came to content that often liberated them in creative ways, and that their creative solutions to these problems became terribly interesting, such that I would argue, and I'm certainly not the first person to say this, that, you know, Hollywood's depiction of sex, and particularly women, women's roles in sexual relationships in the 30s in particular, were significantly more interesting, significantly more ambitious, than I would argue than they are today, and that they have been, you know, for the last 20, 30 years. Because you can do anything now, because you can show anything now, one doesn't need to be clever. One can just say it, show it, do it. And while I certainly wouldn't want to take anybody's freedom of expression away, particularly artistically, I do think you could make a pretty strong case for the idea that it can promote a kind of laziness when it comes to telling a story. When you think about all the ways that an actress like Bette Davis or Katharine Hepburn suggested the ways that they were being transgressive within their society, the ways in which they were overcoming inherent obstacles, which, interestingly enough, both represented obstacles in the society of the day they lived, but also within the industry in which they worked. Both Davis and Hepburn were very affected by the Hollywood studio system and you know, kind of bridled against those kinds of restrictions and often won battles by their, you know, refusal to accept or play by the rules. As a result, I would argue, some of the characters they created were just tremendously interesting and textured and nuanced and much, much more interesting relative to the kind of straight-ahead, unfiltered depictions of women that one finds today in mainstream Hollywood films. So, you know, kind of getting back to the video game thing here, it just struck me seeing this kind of hyper-realistic trailer for Beyond Good and Evil 2 with this kind of hyper Pixar CG graphic kind of thing where you can see like every pore on Paige's face practically. Now, Beyond Good and Evil looks like any other CG film you've seen. You know, it's a desert that looks sort of straight out of a Star Wars film. Whereas the original Beyond Good and Evil, with its highly stylized worlds rendered in a much more cel-shaded, kind of animated look, much more expressive, much more visually interesting, and much more room for an art director to kind of play with that and strike a certain kind of visual style that's unique to the world itself. I mean, let's face it, if you're gonna design something with photorealism as your kind of central design principle, how much unique territory can you stake out with that? I mean, if you want to make a desert look like a desert, if you want to make a Jeep look like a Jeep, if you want to make a pig look like a pig, we've all been there. I don't know. I'm not sure what the interest is in conveying such hyper-realistic versions of such things other than to sort of prove you can do it. And after you've done it, what then? The original Beyond Good and Evil, each of the areas of that world are rendered in rather lush detail, I think, and give the visual designer, the art director, a real chance at etching out a distinctive, singular, signature world. Now, the other thing that Beyond Good and Evil has me thinking about, and this is completely unrelated to art direction and visual style, is the question of how a narrative can be transmitted to a player, how a player experiences a narrative in a very kind of developer-directed narrative, an experience where the player navigates a preordained path and experiences things in the order in which they're designed to be experienced, and essentially, in a linear kind of way, a story is told and I experience that story. Now, we've been doing this for a long time, from, you know, point-and-click adventures through Beyond Good and Evil through, I'm supposing, Metal Gear Solid 4. There's a pre-existing story that is revealed to the player through gameplay, and you reach the end of it, and that's that. Now, of course, the other way of telling a story, there's more than just one way, several, but another kind of dominant way in video games would be a more open world setting where the player has much more impact on the creation of a character and on choices that the character makes. And this led me to think about Grand Theft Auto 4 and some things that I think are interesting connecting that to Beyond Good and Evil. Obviously, the whole kind of narrative aesthetic of GTA 4 is that the player has much more control and the player makes choices and the player has a whole series of ways of impacting the world, way, way more thorough than one could impact the world in Beyond Good and Evil. In fact, there are very few ways at all that the player impacts the world beyond just, you know, the completion of story missions you know, doing things that you must do in order to get to the next level. Obviously, with GTA 4 and other such games, you know, one can get off the path, go do other things, come back to the path. You have certain choices. If you decide not to do certain things, then certain people live or certain people die. So there's that. But there's something interesting, I think, that's come up as we look harder at GTA 4 and as we examine, having spent more time with the game, kind of what that game really tells us about narrative. And it really kind of boils down to this. And I'm not sure that I think this is necessarily an improvement, although it an improvement over Beyond Good and Evil. But it certainly has a kind of ambition attached to it that, you know, one can see where we might eventually be able to do a little better. It has to do with this. One may decide to play Nico in GTA 4 in a number of ways, and you could approach it much like some people have written, and Guy Kroll and others have written, that they sort of chose to do or not to do certain things in the game because of Nico's personality. So rather than getting out a rocket launcher and, you know, blowing away an enemy or a series of cops or whatever, you may or may not do that depending on the way that you respond to Nico's character and the kind of fidelity that you might have towards playing the game in a way that you think he would play it. And that's a certain way of role-playing in that game. But here's where the disconnect comes, and it's where I think that kind of experience derails a bit in terms of narrative, where a game like Beyond Good and Evil doesn't, because it's so much more prescriptive. As many people have pointed out, I can try to be as nice a guy as I can. I can do things in my own way and try to play the game in a positive or a virtuous way. But ultimately, in order for me to simply make my way through the game in its mission structure, there is an unmistakable kind of homicidal, maniac aspect to Nico's personality that I cannot resist, that I cannot deter. I have a certain amount of impact, but I hit a wall at a certain point, and that impact becomes limited by the designers. And in order for me to progress, I've got to do sort of a series of horrible things. So you can sort of create a kind of gentleman murderer, you know, if you want, a kind of gentle homicidal maniac, Nico, but he's still going to have to be homicidal. And in some ways, I think the game really takes this out of your hands more than you might like when he has to really go, I think, beyond where you might feel comfortable. That it's not just, well, I don't want to have to kill this one guy, but I'll do it because I have to be able to satisfy this or that objective. You know, you have to do significantly more unsavory things than that. And at what point in that process does my connection to the character, my empathetic connection, and my way of understanding who that character is based on my choices, at what point does that just stop me? And at what point does that just kind of ultimately destroy that relationship between me and the character? With Jade and, you know, with Hamlet, with, you know, Oedipus, one doesn't worry about those things because the story is not of your making. That your empathetic hooks into the story are based on other things. They're based on your understanding of the relationship that character has to the other characters or choices that character makes or whatever. But your hook into that character isn't based on your own set of decisions. So on the one hand, you could say, well, I would prefer an experience where I have more input and I have more control over the creation of this character, and that ultimately is where video games ought to go. I don't disagree with that. But if you take GTA 4 as an example, I'm not sure, frankly, that is a more satisfying narrative, character, empathetic connection experience, which I think is what they're aspiring to. I think you listen to Rockstar talk, that's what they want. They want you to invest yourself in this game in a deep way and to care about Nico. If that's the objective, frankly, I'm not sure that game succeeds as well as Beyond Good and Evil. So, just a point of view. I'm sure many people will disagree, and I think the minute you start talking about GTA 4, it's a hotbed of controversy. That's fine. If you have another point of view about that, I'd love to hear from you. But from where I sit, I think Nico's really cool, and I think there's a whole lot of amazing stuff in that game. But just as a character, just in terms of my engagement with a character, I'll take Jade over Nico any day. Okay, I'm going to wrap up the podcast with a couple of email listener questions, and I also have an MP3 question that I'll get to. You know, these are great questions, and I could go on and on and on. I mean, they could do whole podcast segments or whole blog posts on these questions, and I don't have time to do that. So I'm going to be perhaps a little more concise than I would like to be with this. But I'm sure you understand. It's sort of like I tell my students, any question that could be answered in two or three sentences is not a very good question. So now, there, of course, is another pressing reason why I don't want to spend too much time on these questions, and it is this. My package just arrived, and Metal Gear Solid 4 is waiting for me downstairs. True, I'm not kidding. My wife just told me that a package came. So, you know, I'm not going to blow through these, I promise, but I also want to make sure that I get to my game because it's beckoning me. First question is from a good friend of the blog and the podcast, Ben Abraham, and he asks me if I happen to listen to the latest Gamma Sutra podcast with the guest. Tom Kim's guest was Ian Simons, and in fact, I did listen to it. And before I'll read his question, but before I do, I just want to mention that Gamma Sutra podcast was off the air for some time because Tom Kim was away for some health reasons, and he's sort of publicly spoken about that, so I want to be sure I didn't say anything that would be inappropriate, but I'm just so glad he's back, and I know a lot of people are, and I know Tom listens to this podcast sometimes, so Tom, if you're listening, it's really great to have you back in the podcast community, and you are a big contributor to our understanding of video games, and welcome back. Okay, so here's Ben's question. I'd love to hear your take on the latest Gamma Sutra podcast with Ian Simons. I thought his way of talking around the games as art discussion was very interesting. He asked Tom Kim about what would happen if tomorrow games were proved not to be art. And his own kind of response was similar, if I remember correctly, to, well, it doesn't matter much because games are still interesting and the people making them are interesting. I couldn't help but make the connection between Kieran Gillen's New Games Manifesto and this kind of philosophy. And he goes on to describe the new games journalism philosophy as, you know, sort of an ethnographic kind of travel writing approach where the writer talks as much about the gamer as the game, and the experience of playing the game matters as much as the design or the details of the game itself. So I think what Ben's getting at is, you know, what do I make of this so-called new games journalism manifesto and Ian Simons' take on the whole thing. Well, I'm going to sit on the fence here to a certain degree, as I often do, because I'm a kind of a believer in the middle way, not as a way of avoiding it, but really as a kind of pure belief system for me, that I don't think a purely technical read of games, a kind of an owner's manual of here are the feature list checkpoints and here are the 8 design mechanics and whatever, that sort of inventory approach to game reviewing or games journalism is very useful by itself. But it does have some value, I think, when you're trying to take a good hard look at, you know, kind of what a game is and how it's built and what are its constituent components. Likewise, I think quote unquote new games journalism, or, you know, very kind of related to kind of a Hunter S. Thompson gonzo journalist approach, which is to really talk about the gamer, the experience of playing the game, and think about it as a visceral thing. That's also very valuable. And I really admire that kind of writing. And I have to say, I can't think of a games writer that I admire more than Kieran Gillen. I mean, he's just terrific. And I read his stuff pretty religiously and have for some time. But I would also hate to think that that is the only respectable or legitimate mode of writing or thinking about games as well. That it does seem to me that we come at this from a lot of different places. If you listen to what I do and read what I write, I'm obviously very interested in narrative and characters, and my training in theater and film is just, you know, inevitably brought to bear understanding games through that lens. That means, I think, that I'm probably less apt to be very good at seeing games through other lenses. And I don't think there's much we really need to be concerned about there. I think gonzo journalists and technical journalists and featureless journalists and whatever, as long as we're thinking hard about games as a community, and we can kind of surround this topic from a scholarly way and from an enthusiast way, I'm really not terribly concerned about the state of video game journalism, honestly, and I know a lot of people are. I do have some concerns, and I've written about them a bit on my blog. I don't want to go into it here, but I honestly think that by and large, this medium is so front and center in terms of the amount of attention that it receives from all kinds of people. And clearly, academic scholarship is growing and becoming more respectable as it relates to video games. So you can kind of add that component as well. I don't know. Call me disengaged or naive or whatever, but I'm just not terribly concerned. I loved Ian Simon's take. I think it makes sense. I think what he's doing is great, and his festival is terrific. And I admire the ludologists, and I admire the narratologists, and I really am not terribly interested in figuring out who's right and who's wrong in the whole games journalism or game studies debate. So I hope that answers your question, Ben, and thanks for sending it in. Now, I have a couple of other questions, one from email and one sent via MP3, and they both kind of focus on the same thing. So I'm going to read the one, and then I'll play the MP3 file, and then I'll get to answering both of them. And as I think you'll see, they kind of weave together some similar concerns. This is from Manveer Hare, who is a game designer for Raven Software. I've mentioned him here on the podcast and on the blog before. He writes the Design Rampage blog, which is wonderful and very astute. He's also written this really cool series on his own blog, but also for Gemma Sutra on design lessons, which is sort of from a designer's point of view. He plays certain games and then kind of steps back and points out the interesting design lessons that can be gleaned from these games that he's been playing. Really great stuff. So Manveer, thanks for your question. He says, I'm worried about your dismissal of Wii Fit as not a game in a recent podcast, but I may be misinterpreting your comments. Sports at their core are games. Wii Fit seems to be a collection of sports simulations, mostly with some yoga and other balance exercises thrown in. I agree this is a very different type of game, and to call it a game without explanation of how it is a game is probably not a good idea. However, referring to any type of game as just a game is how we get into the whole mess of people talking, thinking all games are for kids. We need to clarify what we mean by game when grouping anything into the category. I was wondering if you could clarify your position on Wii Fit as a game and how you feel it fits. I know you put it in your gaming tripod post, so I think I may just be misunderstanding what you meant. And here's the MP3 question. It comes from Roger Travis.
Hi, Michael. I just finally got a chance to listen to Podcast 13 yesterday. Congrats on yet another excellent one, and keep them as long as you want. I think your gaming tripod metaphor is really interesting, although I should say, as a classicist, I think I may be picturing the wrong thing. As a guy who tends to always put narrative first, I had one question about it. Why did you decide to go with only one narrative leg of the tripod, and along the same lines, why did you leave out MMOs? Thanks for everything you're doing with the Brainy Gamer, and I look forward to lots of conversation to come.
Okay, Manveer and Roger, thank you very much for your questions. Roger is, by the way, a classics professor at the University of Connecticut, and he also has a blog. Everybody has a blog today, don't they? I think everybody's got a blog. I don't know anybody that doesn't have a blog. His blog is called Living Epic, and if you've have any interest in the humanities or, ancient history, classics, and you happen to also like video games, you really need to head over to Roger's blog because he's doing stuff that really nobody else is doing, as far as I know. His project, How Games and Gamer Culture Relate to the Ways in Which We've Always Been Telling Stories and the ways in which, his work in classics kind of intersects both culturally and also in terms of storytelling in all kinds of interesting ways with video games. So, I'll put a link up on my blog to his blog, and you can link it on your blog and then tell your friend who has a blog to head over to that blog. I'm getting punchy here. I want to play Metal Gear Solid 4, everybody. okay, what was I saying? Yes, the answer to the question. The gaming tripod really was an effort for me to sort of suggest And I don't know how much water this holds, quite honestly. I think it holds water, but you know, my effort was to suggest that gaming has really turned into a three-pronged thing now, whereas it used to be two. And the one, of course, is very ludic games, you know, from Tetris kind of on, you know, games that are just purely about gameplay. There's no effort to tell a story or represent anything or create characters or anything like that. It's purely manipulate this over here as fast as you can, or avoid this as quickly as you can, or whatever, shoot this as fast as you can, and that's it. Play. They're fully playful games. And then, of course, there are narrative games. And I think Roger's question really sort of suggests that this can be broken out into all kinds of different kind of little mini legs. And I totally agree. RPGs are a very different narrative experience than Beyond Good and Evil, for example, which is we were talking about earlier. And then break that out into MMOGs, and then you've got a whole different set of ways of telling stories and a different set of kind of cultural experiences that you share. But I guess I would argue that it's very possible to lump all of these, however awkwardly, into that leg that says, this is gaming that is largely about storytelling and role-playing. And even if you aren't strictly role-playing, you know, I don't think Beyond Good and Evil is a role-playing game. There is a certain kind of character connection that one makes with Jade that I wouldn't define necessarily as role-playing, but it's definitely empathetic, and there are some connections you might make to the ways in which that kind of storytelling, you know, connects you, bonds you to a character, and you know, there's a whole narrative construction there, just like there's, in a different way, a narrative construction in an RPG, a narrative construction in a Zelda game, you know, all kinds of different narrative experiences. So I know that that's probably a little awkward, but I still think that fundamentally, ludic and narrative experiences in games can be separated, even though they often intersect and often coexist within the same game. Now, the point that I was really trying to make with the gaming tripod was more about, and I think this is what Manveer's getting at, more about the third leg, which I think is neither ludic nor narrative, although it can definitely have elements of those. Games like Wii Fit, games like Brain Age, where it's clear that there are certainly gamey aspects to it. And you know, I would argue with Manveer's suggestion that the yoga stuff and the balance stuff is kind of tacked on, that it's really a series of games. I would reverse that. I think the games feel tacked on to me in Wii Fit, and the real core experience of that game are the strength training, the yoga, which is, I think, exceptionally good, and the feedback that the system gives you, the trainer, the whole way that you interact with the game, in my view, lends itself much more towards that kind of fitness, health, lifestyle sort of role for gaming that really is new. It's not a narrative thing, and it's not necessarily a ludic thing. Now, granted, you know, the downhill skiing, the header soccer stuff, those are pure games, and those are purely fun. And so, yeah, I get that. And I don't mean to suggest that they aren't games. They are games inside Wii Fit. But again, I think if you boil these down to their kind of fundamental natures, I see Wii Fit as more about lifestyle and human personal development. And there's a certain way that gameplay helps accentuate that experience, but it's not about gaming. It's about getting fit. Now, how well they do this, how good the science is behind all that, that's a whole separate thing, and I'm not arguing in any way about that. But I hope that helps explain kind of what I meant by the tripod. Lots of intersections among each leg, but really I do think fundamentally each of those three legs are distinctive. And, you know, who knows, is there a fourth leg on the way? Will the tripod become a table? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. So thanks very much for your questions, Roger and Manveer. I hope that was useful. So that's the podcast. I want to thank all of you very much for joining me. I'm very grateful for your interest in my work, both here and on the blog. Your interest and your participation in this whole Brainy Gamer project is very meaningful to me, and I'm very grateful for it. So thanks again. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. See you next time.